Hey, good morning, everyone. My name is Sten. If this is your first time here, if we never had a chance to meet yet, I'm the pastor here, and we are so glad to have you here. We are in the very, very last week of a series called The Hope Quotient. It's a series that's been designed to help raise the level of hope in our lives. I really do believe that hope is a very very powerful force in our lives. In fact, I wonder how many of you have heard the story about two identical twin brothers. They were alike, these two twin brothers. They were alike in every single possible way but one. One of these twin brothers was a hope-filled, optimistic little boy who only saw the bright side in every situation in life. The other was a dark, kind of sad pessimist who only saw the downside in every single situation. The parents began to get so worried about this. These two extremes in optimism and pessimism in their two twin boys. So they decided to take them to the doctor. And this doctor suggested a plan to these parents. He said, on their next birthday, he said, do this. On their next birthday, give the pessimist a shiny, a brand new bike, but give the optimist only a pile of manure. Okay, it seemed like a fairly extreme thing to do. After all, these parents had always treated their boys very equally, and so this kind of felt a little bit weird. But in this instance, they decided to try the doctor's advice. So when the twins' birthday came around, they gave the pessimist the top of the line, the most expensive, the shiniest, most brand new racing bike that a kid has ever owned. And when he saw the bike, his first words were, "I'll probably crash and break my leg." Okay, any of you like that? Okay, the optimists, on the other hand, they gave a very carefully wrapped box of manure. Okay, and he opened it, and he looked a little puzzled for a moment. And then a big smile appeared on his face, and he ran outside screaming with excitement. His parents followed him outside and asked, like, "What are you so excited about? It was only a box of manure." And the kid yells, "You can't fool me. Where there is this much manure, there's got to be a pony around here somewhere." Okay, that's a hope-filled, optimistic little kid. Right, and that has the ability to change things. But here's the thing. Here's what I really do believe to be true, that hope, it is really something so much more. This is funny. This is a great story. But I really do believe to the core of my being that hope is something so much more than just blind optimism or just wishful thinking. Right? I really believe that hope is a powerful, powerful force in our lives that helps us to stay encouraged, that helps us to navigate the roller coaster that sometimes this life can be. And so what we've done over the past 7-8 weeks here, what we've done is we've used stories and we've used lessons and we've used truths from the Bible to help us identify 7 principles that I think can help raise the level of hope in every one of us. Here is a quick review in case you forgot, or in case you haven't been here for all of these or any of them all. Here's a quick review of the 6 principles that we've covered so far. Number 1, recharge your batteries, right? No one does well running on empty. Number 2, raise your expectations. We kind of flipped through story after story in the Bible, and we discovered that the greatest outcomes in life, they begin with the greatest expectations of the greatest God. So we have to raise our expectations about what is possible when God is working for us. Number 3 was this: refocus on the future. No one goes forward well when they are looking back. Right? So in all things, at all times, we have to learn to ask this one question: what can this become? Not what is, not what has been, or not how things have gone so far, but we've got to be refocused on the future, asking, hey, what can this become? Then number 4, play to your strengths. We looked at the story of David and Goliath, and we determined that when we pair what we do naturally with what God can do supernaturally, the results can be off the charts. Okay, then number 5 was this: refuse to go alone, right? You can go from hero to zero pretty fast, and this is what happened to David. You can go from zero to hero pretty fast when you choose to go alone, right? Some of the biggest mistakes that we make happen when we choose to go alone, right? And so we have to have the right kind of people in our life. We talked about 5 of them last week. And then number 6, this was, that was 2 weeks ago, and then it was just last week. The 6th principle was this: to replace burnout with balance. right? We looked at the story of two sisters who welcomed Jesus in their home, and we determined that if we're going to replace burnout with balance, we have to learn to do two things. Number one, prioritize the important over the urgent. Catch that, right? We have to learn how to prioritize the important over the urgent, and we have to learn which balls are okay to drop in life. Some of the balls that we juggle, family, friends, health, faith, some of these balls are rubber balls, and they bounce back. And we've got to know which balls are okay to drop in life. Today, we're going to bring this series to a close. And there's one more principle that I think we really need to learn in order for hope to be on the rise in us. If we're going to walk forward every day with greater levels of hope and encouragement in us, there's one more principle that we have to learn. And if you're a football fan, you might be able to help me introduce this very last principle. In fact, if you watch the NFL on Sunday afternoons, or if you are in the room while your husband watches the NFL on Sunday afternoons, you will probably have heard this little phrase being tossed around regarding what a team needs in order to win the coveted Super Bowl. Commentators, coaches, players, sports writers, they can often be heard talking about what it takes to win a championship. So often, here's what they say. Maybe you can help me out. They say that what wins championships? Defense wins championships. Right? You hear it all the time. Defense wins championships. Now, whether you agree with that or not, we're not going to get into like an ESPN talk show debate here this morning. So whether you agree with that or not, that defense wins championships, one thing is for sure, that defense is incredibly important. It's important when you're on the football field, where you're on the basketball court, or where you're on the baseball field, and it's pretty darn important too in the life that we live. And this idea of defense, it's the foundation of this seventh and final principle that I think we need to put into play in our life if hope is going to be on the rise in us. We have to play great defense. When it comes to this life that we're living, this kind of race that we're running that we'll see, we have to play great defense. Defense is simply this. I looked it up just to see what the dictionary actually tells us. Defense is this. It says it's the action of defending from or resisting attack. Okay, pretty simple. That's defense. The action of defending from or resisting attack. I think in many ways, oftentimes, we're under attack, right? And sometimes it's not always just from the things out there, but sometimes it's from the things right in here. But one way or another, I think we're under attack. Here's the truth. The world doesn't necessarily operate with your best interest in mind, right? Life doesn't always deal you the hand that you were hoping for, right? Marriage isn't always as dreamy as your honeymoon, right? Raising kids isn't always as peaceful as the first couple months when your kid sleeps three quarters of the day and you watch Netflix all evening with your wife and a sleeping child behind you. It's not always that peaceful, right? Choosing a next step in life or in career, it's not always so clear. Holding on to purity, to values, to morals in you, it doesn't always go as planned. I could go on and on with more examples of these, but I think you get what I'm getting at here, right? Life is not always a giant cakewalk. And so because of that, we really have two choices. As we move forward every day in this life, we really have two choices. We can either kind of sit on our hands, and we can just kind of let life come our way, knocking us from side to side, knocking us back and forth with whatever comes from around the bend, or we can play great defense, right? We can actively and intentionally be on guard, be kind of protecting ourselves from the things that are coming at us, from the things that are creeping up in us, right? Protecting ourselves from those things that are attacking us. It's playing great defense, right? And tucked within a letter, tucked within just a short verse in a letter that's written to a church, most likely in Rome, thousands of years ago, we find a clue about how we do that, about how we actually play great defense. This letter that I'm referring to is actually the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, right? And in actuality, this entire book, it was really a sermon, actually. The entire book of Hebrews is actually a sermon composed by a pastor to a bunch of Christians in Rome who are kind of falling away from the faith they had developed, that had kind of started in them. Old habits, old ways of thinking, old ways of life, old traditions, from a religion that they had once held. It started to kind of creep in. And they started to fall away from this new faith in Jesus Christ. And so this pastor in the book of Hebrews, he's writing them in a big, long letter, much longer than what I'm going to share here this morning. You should be glad to know. Okay, he takes this letter to address these people. It's Hebrews. And in Hebrews chapter 12, this pastor writes this to him. We start to see what it might mean for us to play great defense in our lives. Here's what he writes, Hebrews chapter 12. He says, therefore, very first verse, he says, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. We'll just take a time out here really quick there to figure out what he's talking about. This great cloud of witnesses, what is that? He's actually referring to like the spiritual Hall of Fame list that he's just rattled off in chapter 11. Just one chapter before, he has just listed the accomplishments and the great feats of some of the Bible's most prominent all-stars. And he's in each of them, he's referring to the faith that they had in what they could not see. So he the whole chapter, chapter 11, he goes on. He says, by faith, Noah built the ark. By faith, Abraham moved to a place he did not know. By faith, Jacob. By faith, Moses. By faith, Joseph. And so on and so on and so on with this list of characters. He's saying, by faith, by faith, by faith. All these people went on to do such great things. And so the writer finishes this Hall of Fame rundown, and then he starts in chapter 12, and he says, okay, because all of these people have gone on to do such great things because of a faith that they had in what they could not see, because of the extraordinary lives that they lived, he's saying, okay, now let's follow in their footsteps. And his main piece of advice for their life is precisely how we play great defense in our life. Here's what he says. Since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off. Let us throw off everything that hinders us and the sin that so easily entangles us. And let us run with perseverance the race that's marked out before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and the perfecter of our faith. He's saying, run the race with perseverance. Throw off the stuff that gets in our way. This is actually really pretty brilliant here, what he's doing here and how he's writing, right? If we thought that modern day preachers were the only ones that knew how to use relevant analogies and connections to everyday life, if we thought that that was just modern day preachers who knew that little trick, Hebrews reminds us otherwise, right? In a Roman culture where sports and athletics were a prominent way of life, this author, throughout this whole letter, throughout this whole sermon, this author is using athletic themes and running themes and running races as a theme. He uses it throughout this whole letter, and in doing so, his audience that he's writing to would get a better sense of what he's talking about, and so we get a better sense too. And whether you're running a race in a coliseum or on a track or in life, there are things that we need to throw off, right, that are hindering us, that are holding us down. There are things that we need to throw off and push aside so that they will not slow us down, as they will not hold us back. Right? We have to push off anything that is attacking the hope inside of us. That's playing great defense. And if we're going to run this race with perseverance, if we're going to stay in this game of life for the long haul, if we're going to walk with more levels of hope every day in our lives, I think we got to stay on guard. We got to be in the right position, and we got to work hard to throw off and push away anything and everything that hinders us from doing that. To doing it well, to doing it while staying encouraged, and to do it with greater levels of hope in us. I think there are five major things that creep in, five major things that start to hold us back, five major things that start to hinder us, that start to attack us right inside our very own hearts, five things that start to attack the hope that's building in us, five things that we need to work hard to throw off. Here's the first one right here. It's bitterness and resentment. Right, maybe these are five things that you want to write down for yourself. Here's the first one, bitterness and resentment. Author Ray Johnston, he says this. He says, bitterness and the resentment that follows are nothing but emotional suicide. And he said, they poison you and everyone around you. That's a pretty extreme statement. emotional suicide, poison, right? These are strong word choices for him to use, but he's not just making this up. This isn't just his own opinion. Just a few verses down in the same book of Hebrews, in the same chapter actually even, just a few verses down, the author writes this to these people that he's addressing. He says, watch out. Watch out that no poisonous root of what? Bitterness. Watch out that no poisonous root of bitterness grows up to trouble you, corrupting many. Where does anything with the potential to grow, whether it's good or bad, where does anything with the potential to grow, where does it begin? Where does it start? In the root. Right, it's in the part that nobody can see. It's in the part that lies kind of just underneath, just below the surface. And so this pastor is warning us not to let even the roots of bitterness to start to grow in us, because it will cause trouble, right? If we can be honest here, bitterness and resentment, man, that creeps into all of us at different times. I'm not immune from that, right? In the moment, it kind of feels good to hold on to these kind of feelings, but here's the truth. It might feel good in the moment, but it does not do an ounce of good in your life. Right, it actually just poisons maybe some of the relationships that could mean the most, and it corrupts the heart that's inside of you and me. So when this creeps in, right, this kind of bitterness, this kind of resentment that follows, our first reaction needs to be to throw it off. Right, it is poison for our souls. The question is, could this be the case for you? All right, we got to throw it off. Here's the second thing. Worry and anxiety, right? This can be such a killer for so many people, right? Not only is worry, and for some of us, that's a big deal, man. The things that we worry about, the things that are on our minds when we, you know, lay awake at sleep, when we're trying to sleep at night, right? These things are on our minds. Not only is worry a serious threat, I think, to the hope that's in us, right, to the peace and kind of the joy in us. But worry, I was surprised to read, is actually connected to so many like physical health concerns of ours. It's actually connected to high blood pressure, to heart trouble, to blindness, to migraines, to thyroid malfunction, and a number of stomach diseases. Right, I read this week in a book that Dr. Alexis Carroll, the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize in Medicine, said this, that people who do not know how to fight worry die young. Right, the people that do not know how to fight worry die young. I started thinking about this, and just in my own mind, I started thinking, okay, maybe if you don't die young, right, if you don't know how to fight worry and you don't die young, I'm thinking you don't die happy. Right, worry and anxiety can be such a difficult thing for us, right, and it robs us of the joy in the present moment. In his famous sermon, it's like the most famous sermon that Jesus ever gave. It's the Sermon on the Mountain, right? Jesus is speaking to crowds of people who have come to hear him speak. And he has more to say about worry than about any other topic, because it's that big of a deal. Here's just a glimpse of what he has to say. This is Matthew 6, verses 25 and 27. He says, therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. He says, is not life more than food and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds in the air. They don't sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. He says, are you not much more valuable than they are? And then he finishes saying this, can any of you, right? This is what we need to ask ourselves. He says, can any of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? Can you add a single hour? Can you add a single moment? Can you add a single minute to your life by worrying? No, you can't. Right? So the question for all of us is then, what do we do with these things that we cannot control? Right? Because there are a lot of things that out there that we just simply can't control. What do we do with those things? 1 Peter 5:7 urges us to do this. It says, cast all your anxiety on him. Why? Because he cares for you. A lot of things that we can't control in life. So cast those things. Cast your anxiety on him, on God, because he cares for you. I think some of you need to hear that this morning, that God cares for you. Right? He cares about the things that you care about. He cares about the things that scare you. He cares about the things that trouble you. And he cares about the things that worry you. Right? So you have to let God handle those things that you cannot. A lot of things that you can control, that you can address in your life, but there's a lot of things that you simply don't have any control over yet that fill your mind and fill you with worry and fill you with anxiety. You have to let God handle those things that you cannot. Cast your anxiety on him. Why? Because he genuinely cares for you. If we're going to play great defense, we have to learn to throw off, push it off, get it out of the way. Throw off worry, and at all costs, we have to cast our anxiety on God. Our own health, it might be on the line, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Got to throw it off. Here's number three, comparison. This is a killer. This is an absolute killer. Comparison is actually a trap. It's a trap because when we step in and start to play this comparison game, all comparison does is it leads to two things. Okay, comparison, it either leads to pride or to envy, right? When we step in and start to play the comparison game, it either leads to pride or it leads to envy. And pride says, I'm better than you, right? You look out at the people around you and pride says, I'm better than you. I'm smarter than you. I'm better looking than you. I have more money than you. I'm whatever better than you, right? And that's a dangerous place to be. The flip side of it is envy. You look around and you say, I want what you have. I don't have enough. I want what you just got. I need to get more of what you have. It's pride or envy, right? And neither is good for us. And the thing is, when you play this comparison game, you lose every single time. A few weeks back, we looked at part of the life of David, right? A couple weeks in a row we actually did. First one, we looked at when David, a little teenage boy, really, we looked at when David defeated a 9-foot tall giant named Goliath. And then we fast forwarded. The next week, we kind of fast forwarded to a time when he was a king, actually, king over all of Israel, right? Well, the king just before him, right, the king just before David, the king who was actually king at the time when David defeated Goliath, it was a guy by the name of King Saul. And Saul's unraveling as king of Israel, it began when he started to play the comparison game. Right? If you look in 1 Samuel 17, this is when David defeats Goliath. We kind of looked at that a few weeks ago. Right? David defeats Goliath. He wins the battle for the entire nation of Israel, of whom Saul was the leader of. So, right? So this should be a reason for the king of Israel. This should be a reason for Saul to begin to celebrate, right? Not so fast. Okay, that's 1 Samuel 17. Let's look now into 1 Samuel 18. It says this, starting in verse 6. It says, when the victorious Israelite army was returning home after David had killed the Philistine, this giant named Goliath, it says this, women from all the towns of Israel came out to meet King Saul. Right? You think that this might put a smile on his face. Okay, women from all the towns came out to greet King Saul. They sang and they danced for joy with tambourines and cymbals. And this was their song. Saul has killed his thousands and David his 10,000s. Verse 8, it says this. This made Saul very angry. What's this? He said. They credit David with 10,000s and me only with thousands. He starts playing the comparison game. And he says, next they'll be making him their king. And verse 9 ends like this. It says, so from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. This kind of jealousy, this comparison game, this trap, it was the beginning of what took Saul out, right? It was the beginning of the end for him. It was the beginning of what took Saul out, and it could be the very same thing that takes you out too, right? So you have to play great defense, and you have to refuse to let the comparison game, the comparison trap take hold of you. You know, right? You have a sense inside of you. You know if this is a game that you often play. so often it is for many of us, right? You know if this is the game that you play, and if it is, you got to play great defense. And you got to throw off comparison as often as you can. Here's number four, just two left. Here's number four, guilt. This can be a pretty heavy burden for so many people. This actually can mess up guilt, right? That the feelings of guilt that we carry on our shoulders, that this feeling of guilt can actually mess up so many of the relationships that matter most in our lives. Here's just a small picture of how that can be true, a very small picture. When Erica, my wife and I, lived in Menominee, our yard was just about a half acre big, and so we ended up buying the old riding lawnmower from the woman that we bought our house from. Well, this last summer, we obviously moved to Hudson, and our yard was quite a bit smaller, and so we didn't need this riding lawnmower any longer. But I actually sold it to my father-in-law, who had just bought a new place and was in need of a riding lawnmower. It was an old lawnmower when we bought it. And let's just say that I wasn't meticulous in its maintenance and upkeep. But it always worked great for me, and it was always super reliable for me. So I felt pretty good about selling it and getting myself a mower that I needed. Well, a couple of weeks ago, this is the honest to God truth, a couple of weeks ago, my father-in-law fired up this riding mower for the first time in the season. Engine fired up, and he stepped into the garage for just a second, and when he came back, the engine was literally on fire. This thing was done. He got a total, honestly, he got a total of like 3 months and 1 day's use out of this mower that he paid me for. When he saw me later, he said he didn't even want to tell me because he knew that I would feel so badly, and I did. And it gets worse. Okay, at the very same time, this is the honest to God truth, at the very same time this spring that he's getting this mower ready for use, I had borrowed some garden clippers from my father-in-law as well. I needed to do some trimming around the edge of our property. And so I got these garden clippers from him, and one of the very first chops that I made was to a big, thick branch of a dying plant. And when I went to make this big chop, the 3/8 of an inch metal bolt that held these things two together, it literally just snapped in two, right? And the two handles came apart. I'm thinking, oh, goodness. Okay, so I go to Home Depot, and I replace the bolt, and I got the thing back together, only to get back home and discover that I didn't get the exact bolt that I needed, okay? It wasn't totally right. It kind of worked, but not like it was supposed to, and so I needed to figure out what was next. Well, the very next weekend, this is actually just last weekend, we're going to see Erica's family. And without telling me, and without me knowing it, Erica threw those clippers in the car to return to her dad, who needed them back at the house. I didn't realize it. They're in the trunk. The clippers that don't really work that well. And so we show up. I go to the back of the car to grab these clippers out of the back, or to grab our stuff for the day out of the back. And what's there is the clippers that I broke. And I freak out. I'm like, Erica, what are the clippers doing in the car? And she's like, well, my dad needed them. I said, well, I know that, but those things don't work right now, and I still got to fix them before we give them back to your dad. But it was too late. Phil sees me, and he comes down to the car, and he says, Sten, Eric said you brought the clippers back. Let me grab them from you. I kid you not, I handed them to him, and he started mumbling a bunch of nonsense about it was a bolt and because it was the branch, and I got this, I had the screw, but and I was there, and I tried to fix it, but it's not the right thing. But I tried, and I didn't know. So okay, it should work. Kind of. Here's the clippers, and I could barely look the dude in the eye. There's this huge sense of like, man, I did something wrong here. Like, it was just too much for me. I could barely look the guy in the eye as I handed these clippers back to him. Here's the thing. These are a few pretty innocent moments, and I know that. And my father-in-law is an incredibly gracious man. There is no harm. There is no foul. But here's what I realize. If even in these moments, right, these innocent moments that I know are so innocent, if even in these moments, that feeling of guilt, like, I messed this up. If even in those moments, that feeling of guilt can drive that kind of wedge between two people, think how much more guilt for bigger wrongs that we're a part of. Think how much more that kind of guilt can drive a wedge between you and others. Think about how much more that kind of guilt could drive a wedge between you and God. Right? For some of you, that wedge is enormous, right? Because the guilt is so big and it's so heavy, right? Some of you, I think, are carrying a heavy burden of guilt for something that you did or that you said maybe 20 years ago. And the truth is, it is nothing more than dead weight at your feet that you're just dragging along with you everywhere you go. It's preventing you and it's holding you back and it's hindering you, right, from connecting to some of the most important people in your life, or maybe more importantly, it's hindering you from connecting to or approaching God for the first time, or maybe for the first time in a long time. It's time to throw off that guilt that stands in the way, that wraps you up. And the Bible is clear about what we need to know about the guilt that we carry for the mistakes that we've made. The Bible is clear about it in so many different places. Here's just a couple. Romans 8:1 says, so now there is no condemnation. There is no punishment for those who are in Christ Jesus. Romans 8:39, it says, there is nothing, not a single thing. There is nothing in all of creation that will be able to separate us from the love of God, right? There is nothing that we could do that mean that we have to kind of shield our eyes when we bring the broken garden clippers back to God. Nothing in all of creation that could separate us from God's love for us. We cannot let guilt hinder us anymore. Cannot let it hinder us from anything or from anyone in our life. We've got to learn how to throw it off. Here's number five. This is the last one, and it's this: past failure. Past failure in our life. Here's the thing: some of us can't remember what we ate for breakfast like 3 or 4 hours ago, but we have an uncanny ability somehow to remember the past failure that we've experienced like 3 or 4, you know, or more years ago in our life, or 5 or 6, or even more than that. I have an uncanny ability to remember the past failure that we've experienced in a time before, right? Failure in marriage, failure in purity, failure in business, failure in parenting, a failure in our finances, right? And this kind of failure, it clings to us like shrink wrap, and it locks us up, and it holds us down, and it hinders us from being able to take any new step or any next step into the future that maybe God wants us to step into. In this condition of ours, I think it's evident in all of us. I think it's evident in two short words that come out of our mouths so often. Two short words are, I can't. I can't. I can't do it. Right, my 4-year-old daughter, she has the unreal ability to remember what it is that she couldn't do a year ago. Right, summer's here, and there's all sorts of fun summer activities that we like to do outside. She has this unreal ability to remember the things that she couldn't do then, and she's convinced that the same is true today. Whether it's riding a bike or jumping off the dock or swimming without her little water wings, everything is, I can't do that, I can't, I can't, I can't. And if I'm honest, I think some of us are the very same. We say, I can't. I can't quit. I can't stay in a committed relationship. I can't get out of debt. I can't stop clicking. I can't stop watching. I can't stop comparing. I can't fill in the blank. I can't. I can't. I can't do it. I can't. If that's you, right, you have to change your vocabulary. Work hard to change your vocabulary from I can't to I can. Philippians 4:13, it says this. As Paul's writing, he says, "For I can do everything through Christ who gives me strength." I can do everything, right? And not just some things. He's like, I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. If we're going to live with greater levels of hope and encouragement in our life, we have to learn to throw off past failure that hinders us and that haunts us and that wraps us up still today. That's playing great defense. Right, we got to be mindful of these things that come into our life. That's playing great defense, and it's absolutely essential for each and every one of us here today. So let me just ask you this question then. Which is it? Which is it that you need to throw off the most? Which one? And maybe it's not even one of these five. Maybe there's something else that is just lighting up in your mind right now that you know is true for you. But which is it? Which one threatens the hope in you? Which one threatens the joy in your life? Right? Whenever it creeps into your life, whenever you notice that one of these things, it's tightening its grip on you, whenever you notice the root of one of these things is starting to form in you, my prayer is that you would be quick to throw it off. It's playing great defense. My prayer is that you would be quick to throw it off. And my hope, here's how I want to close this morning. My hope is that this story that I close, my hope is that this parable, an old farmer's parable, my hope is that this might give you a helpful way to remember how. It's the old parable of a farmer who owned a mule that fell into a well. And maybe you've heard this old farmer's parable before. The farmer owned a mule that fell into an old abandoned well. And the farmer decided that neither the old mule nor the old dry abandoned well were worth saving. Not worth it. And so he enlisted the help of some neighbors to haul some dirt over to the well and to bury the mule in it so that he could just be done with both at the same time. So as the first few shovelfuls of dirt rained down on him, this mule, it was hysterical, right? It just going absolutely nuts. And the dirt didn't stop, right? Shovel after shovelful started to pour down on him. And so as he struggled, all of a sudden a brilliant thought came over this stubborn little mule. And he thought to himself, every time a shovel of dirt lands on my back, I'll just shake it off and step up. And so that's what he did. He shook it off. He stepped up. Shovel after shovel, this stubborn old mule stayed calm, and he kept shaking it off and stepping up. Dirt landed on his back, shake it off, and step up. Before long, the dirt has started to rise. The dirt started filling up the well underneath his feet. And when it was finally high enough, the exhausted old mule, he stepped up and out triumphantly over the top of that well and on into a new chance at life. Right? You and I need to do the same. Right? This is a silly little story, but I think it's some brilliant advice. And I hope that it provides for you a helpful little picture of how we play great defense. When these things come our way, we have to shake it off and step up. And with each step up, we may just be one step closer to a new life and to a better life or to a hope-filled life that God has promised us and that God wants for us. We just have to shake it off and step up. That's playing great defense. Let me pray for us. God, as always, I just ask that in these moments now and in the moments to come, maybe the moments later in this week, God, I just ask that you would help maybe shine a light on these areas in our life that kind of threaten hope most in us, God. Would you shine a light on these areas, and would you do it with only the grace, God, that we know that you would provide for us in these moments, God. We want to know what it is. We want to be aware of the things that are maybe tripping us up or holding us back. We want to know, God, the things that are attacking us, because we want to play great defense. We want to keep these things off and keep them out of our way, God, so we can pursue more of the things, more of the life that you have planned for us, God. So rather than just sitting on our hands and rather than letting curveballs just kind of knock us off course, God, would you help us to be aware of these things, God? Would you lovingly and graciously shine a spotlight on any of these things in us that we need to work hard to throw off? Would you give us strength to do it, God? Would you give us wisdom to know what it is that's happening in life and what it is that we need to address most of all, God? And would you be there? Would you be our strength? Would you be our source of comfort and of hope in each of these new steps that we try to take, God? We're grateful for your word and for the way that it has taught us time and time again over the last 7 and 8 weeks, God. We're grateful for the way that your word teaches us, for the way that it informs us, and for the lessons that we can learn about the life that we're living, God. And I just pray, God, that you would help cement these truths, these lessons, these principles into our lives so that we genuinely would be more people, that no matter what comes our way, that we would be people who learn to walk with greater levels of hope in our lives. And that hope, God, means that things get better in our life. That's our prayer, God. We're grateful for this morning. And we're grateful for all the ways that you teach us. And we're grateful for the ways that you love us, God. And we pray these things in your name. Amen.